The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says his country is yet to fully take its harsh revenge for the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. High-level security talks between Russia and the U.S. get underway in Geneva amid pessimism about the outcome of the negotiations. And fire sweeps through a refugee camp for Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh, leaving thousands of people homeless. This is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is warning that parts of the country's harsh revenge still awaits the U.S. for the assassination of General Soleimani in 2020. IRGC Commander Major General Hossein Salami says Iran's missile strikes on Ain al-Assad military base in Iraq was only part of the response. He said that Washington should know it cannot launch an active aggression against the nation and avoid retaliation. The general says that Iran is not daunted by enemies and will defend its independence. Now, the comments came days after the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination in a U.S. drone strike. Iran responded by hitting the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad with more than a dozen missiles. As the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal continue, Iran says it wants to make sure that the U.S. does not treat the JCPOA with contempt again.
Iran and the U.S. have exchanged views through unofficial written texts on four issues. Those are ensuring the effective removal of sanctions, nuclear commitments, the issue of verification, and obtaining guarantees that no other U.S. administration in Washington would make a mockery of international relations and this agreement.
Now, Khatibzadeh says that the Vienna talks only focus on the full, responsible, and verifiable U.S. return to the deal. The official said that Iran is seeking a lasting and reliable agreement, and the talks have made good progress so far. However, he stressed that Tehran alone cannot maintain the pace of the negotiation and wants the other side to speed up its efforts. Vienna is currently hosting the eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to JCPOA, that's Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and is not directly involved in the talks. Now over to Vienna, to the venue of the talks. Homa Lesgi is there. Homa, what's up? Yesterday we heard some positive signals from both sides. I wonder what the situation is like today.
Yes, Behrouz. So we're hearing that today's meetings are planned for later this evening or late in the afternoon, between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagheri-Kani, and his Russian and Chinese counterparts, separate meetings with them, as well as other meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the JCPOA and the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora. And these meetings between the heads of delegations have been going on since the eighth round of these talks began. As you said, up until this stage, we are hearing some positive notes coming from various parties. Or, for instance, Mr. Bagheri himself saying that things are moving forward and that the atmosphere is that the atmosphere is positive, or as European officials like to put it, businesslike or serious. So there is intense work taking place now, and Iran says that its emphasis in these talks is the two top issues of verification and guarantees, saying that it wants the Americans to give the guarantees required for Iran to be assured that they will not withdraw from the JCPOA again, as happened in 2018 under the Trump administration, and that they will not impose any additional sanctions that would jeopardize the implementation of the agreement. At the same time, they want verification when it comes to sanctions removal, and they say that they will only go back to a full commitment and to their nuclear commitments after the verified removal of U.S. sanctions. And this has been acknowledged by Western sources that because it was the American side that withdrew from the agreement initially, it should also be Washington that takes the initial step in going back to the deal before Iran goes back to its commitments. That will be the topic of discussions when the working group on sequencing or implementation takes place. But at the moment, talks are still continuing on the two issues of sanctions removal, one working group on that issue and another working group on Iran's nuclear commitments. We were hearing comments from the Iranian foreign minister. You just referred there to comments made by the foreign ministry spokesman, but Mr. Amir Abdullahian himself has also said that in the first two rounds of the Vienna talks, it was difficult to reach a common language, in his words, but now things are looking better. He even said that while initially the French side, in the words of Mr. Amir Abdullahian, acted as the bad cop, now they have acknowledged that the Iranian demands are legitimate and they're moving forward. And he was also saying that initially the Americans wanted Iran to give a lot of concessions while they gave none, or in the words that I saw in the one report, the U.S. in its earlier non-papers, Mr. Amir Abdullahian saying demanding 10 points but wanting to give one. But now it looks like there's a more balanced approach coming from the Western side, as far as we know and as far as we're hearing from the Iranian sources. What Iran says is the fact that it has agreed to the JCPOA in 2015 is the compromise that it came with. It is not going to agree to any more concessions or compromises. For instance, it will not agree to an interim agreement. It will not agree to another kind of JCPOA. Some people have called it JCPOA plus, that would include, for instance, longer sunset clauses, etc. What it wants, it says, or its red line, is the text of the 2015 agreement, the JCPOA, and it will not agree to anything more or less than that.
All right. Thanks for that explanation and update, Tamar Leskey in Vienna. Now, moving on, Moscow and Washington holding high-stakes security talks in the Swiss city of Geneva. The discussions are held at the request of Russia, that presented security demands to the U.S. last month. In our news review program, we've discussed the prospects of the talks and their impacts on the Russo-American relations with our guest. Now, senior Russian and U.S. officials are currently sitting at a table for security talks in Geneva amid pessimism about the outcome of the discussions. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov and his American counterpart, Wendy Sherman, are leading the delegations. The two sides also met on Sunday, with Ryabkov afterward describing the meeting as, quote, businesslike and difficult. Moscow's already ruled out making any concession under pressure. And that's why Washington says that no breakthroughs are expected and that progress depends on de-escalation from Moscow. The Russians are also scheduled to hold high-level discussions with NATO and Europeans. The talks are aimed at a wide-ranging new security arrangement between Russia and the West. The Kremlin demands guarantees that NATO will not expand further eastward. Now for some insight on this. So I'll be discussing this issue with Fred Ware, journalist and political commentator in Moscow. Also Greg Simons, researcher with the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, joining us from Uppsala. Welcome, gentlemen. Now, Fred, you heard both sides are asking the other side, you know, to come up with something, and both of them have been pessimistic even before the meeting started, and one round is already finished. They're now in the middle of the second one. So, given the circumstances, what do you expect to come out of these talks?
I think we need to look past the public posturing. They are putting forward their maximal views in public. But the fact is, these meetings are taking place. If both sides believed that that's all there is, these two irreconcilable positions, they wouldn't bother. This has been set up. It's been backed up by two conversations of President Biden and Putin in the last month. And it's carrying on with very high-level delegations on both sides. Clearly, I'm sure it's difficult and businesslike and all that, but both sides must see something that they can arrive at. It may not resemble either of their two extreme positions, but it might be something that will make Europe a somewhat safer place.
Mm-hmm. Now, Greg, how do you look at this? Russia wants security guarantees. How can Russia make sure it will get these guarantees? Because, you know, given the past U.S. performance, it even writes and signs something, it simply scraps it, just like the Iran nuclear deal.
Yes, well, even if under the extreme example that they do get the security guarantees, which I do not think they will, then will they abide by those security guarantees, which I doubt? Because if we remember back, Gorbachev received such security guarantees, and they haven't been lived up to, and they've been incrementally violated ever since. The problem stemming from the fact that the US considers itself the remaining superpower winner of the Cold War, so that it is the one that dictates the global order and these aspects of geopolitics and international relations. But this masks the fact that there is a massive transformation of these international relations and the global order, where the US is losing, in context, its position and influence.
So, Fred, as you know very well, Ukraine is the main bone of contention here. So, what's the solution to Ukraine issue?
Look, it's not the main bone of contention. It's part of it, and it's the most prominent piece. But the main problem for Russia is the relentless expansion of NATO to the east. And I think the reason the Americans are sitting down at the table right now and not 5 years ago or 10 years ago, because Russia's position hasn't really changed, is that they realize that NATO expansion is effectively over. I mean, short of World War III, it's not going to happen. Therefore, the Americans are prepared to cut some sort of a deal. What would satisfy Russia? Well, yes, security guarantees, and they do work. I mean, during the Cold War, there was the process with Finland, which was an arrangement, which kept Finland neutral, sort of with doors open to East and West, had its own democratic political system. Even Stalin accepted that and abided by that arrangement. There was a treaty with Austria whereby the four powers withdrew from Austria, leaving it neutral and also open, east and west. That worked throughout the Cold War. There's no reason why such an agreement can't work. It is underpinned by the reality that NATO expansion isn't going to continue. I think that in the West they realize the force, the impetus after the Cold War, which they fully took advantage of, is petered out. It's finished. Now is the time, if rational minds are at work on both sides, to strike some sort of a deal that can create, I don't know, I don't want to use the word Finlandization, because I know the Finns hate it, but something like that for Ukraine, that will preserve it as a sovereign, independent country, not a member of any bloc, with its doors open both directions, and let the future take care of itself.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Fred Ware, journalist and political commentator of Moscow. Greg Simons, researcher with Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden. The president of Kazakhstan says that historic unrest of the recent days in his country has been an attempt at coup d'etat.
A group of armed militants who were waiting in the wings joined the action. The main goal became obvious: the undermining of the constitutional order, the destruction of the institutions of government, the seizure of power. We are talking about an attempted coup d'etat.
Altakov was speaking with leaders of the Russian-led military alliance in a video conference. His statements were confirmed by his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, who stressed that the alliance would not allow another color revolution to take place. Authorities say that since the start of the widespread demonstrations over a week ago, 164 people were killed and 8,000 arrested, and that in addition to security officers who were either killed or injured. The demonstrations, sparked by increasing fuel prices, marked the deadliest unrest in Kazakhstan's post-Soviet history. Officials, however, say that order has been restored now. The unrest in Kazakhstan has left more than 100 people dead. Public buildings were torched and ransacked in several cities, including the main city, Almaty. The government has called for assistance from the regional security alliance led by Russia to quell the unrest. Moscow has criticized Washington after it said that Kazakhstan would be saddled with a Russian presence.
Russia says the reason behind its decision to provide military support for Kazakhstan is reaffirming its commitment to allied obligations within the Collective Security Treaty Organization. In addition, Moscow views the recent developments in Kazakhstan as externally provoked attempts at disrupting the security and integrity of the state through violent means, including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to cite a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than the United States, because the United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Renaissance paradise turned into an inferno. May the 9th, 2015. When the Westerners during the Renaissance period in Europe separated religion from science and politics, they intended to build a paradise on earth similar to one promised to mankind by religions. That paradise is now turned into an inferno. This is something even admitted by the Westerners themselves. It is true that the religion that European intellectuals in the Renaissance period opposed was not a true religion but a body of superstitions. It was totally against scientific advances and discoveries. This is why Galileo was sentenced to death for his scientific views, and other scientists were also tortured and even died of torture for their scientific discoveries. It was a distorted version of Christianity, not real Christianity. Therefore, there was nothing wrong with parting with this kind of religion in that period. However, the separation of spirituality and morality from science, politics, individual life, and social relations was not a proper thing to do. The Westerners replaced religion by science and rationality and said that there was no need for religion any longer. This was the condition prevailing in the 19th and 20th century. But for the past 40 or 50 years, they have even been defaming rationality, rejecting all rational principles, and advocating relativism and skepticism with regard to all principles, including moral, rational, and even scientific principles. This is not a proper paradigm to be imitated and followed by other nations. Imitating and following a failed model is a big mistake, and it will lead nowhere and promise no bright prospects.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Saint Mary is a role model for believers. August 7th, 2004. At the opposite end of the scale, Allah the Exalted mentions two women as role models for believers. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. Behold, she said, O my Lord, build for me in nearness to you a mansion in the garden, and save me from the Pharaoh and his doings. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 11. One was the wife of the Pharaoh, and the other was Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 12. As for the first woman, she was not beguiled by the Pharaoh's palace. She was a woman who was raised in a Pharaoh-like manner, and most probably her parents and household members were the descendants of the same Taghuts. She was living with utmost comfort and welfare, but faith in Musa conquered her heart, and as a result, she believed in him. When she began to believe and know the path, she abandoned all the comfort and welfare, and she was no more attracted to that great palace. She said, O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden. She preferred a house in paradise, and she attached no significance to the material life. As for Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran, who guarded her chastity, and we breathed into her body of our spirit. She preserved her chastity. These are human values.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law. And we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of 6 coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, 7 more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. 6 civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, 7 more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, 1 more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the Northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is enforced in at least 5 Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. 6 decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers who were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. So the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these, were to be targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way, so that insurgents could be neutralized. Howsoever, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmarese junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is no faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs or movement of insurgents, then these sort of laws actually increase the chances of such incidents being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position, as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir. And on the ground level, you have a lot of presence, the big presence of the ultras or the other, insurgents from the other side are always present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized. And, you know, in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function. And therefore, the Kashmiri situation is very unique. And the Indian state has often cited that as one of the main reasons that has enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also, please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of the right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. the chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Omar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram temple session in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs, and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th, in the heart of Srinagar city, to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represents the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have an agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslim, like Christian, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims, and this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state, and he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities. not only against the Muslim, but also against the Christian and other religions also, like amended Treason Act, canceling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many, many other measures which are extremist, and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many, many times. But recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill-planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many, many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such a situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahman, which are only 8% of the whole population. But they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things. And they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Zubair Amin, a Kashmir-based independent journalist, notes that Kashmiri Muslims have long accused New Delhi of curbing their religious freedom on the pretext of law and order, while promoting and patronizing the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Multimedia journalist from Kashmir, Mukhtar Zahur, pictures a man who traveled 40 kilometers to offer Friday prayers at Kashmir's Central Mosque, only to realize that it has been shut. Masroor Ansari, a senior Kashmiri pro-freedom leader, slams the Kashmir police for brutal use of force to thwart a peaceful Muharram procession in Srinagar recently.
And that was our episode about the growing calls in India for the repeal of a controversial law in the wake of the recent civilian killings in Nagaland state, and also the denial of religious freedom to Kashmiri Muslims by the Indian government. Take care.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his perfect progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools to this show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him. Salam alaikum, Sheikh, welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is concerning the incestuous marriage, that is, marriage with those who are among your mahrams, those who are belonging to you in some way. I mean, they have some relationship to a person. So this question has been asked, and there was a comparison inside this question which was made, that why do people had such an experience at the beginning of the world, like the time of the Prophet Adam, when his sons, that is Abel and Cain, or Habil and Qabil, actually experienced such a marriage, that is they married two sisters. This question, I think, needs to be dissected from a historical and at the same time Islamic point of view. That's why I want a respected Sheikh Nur Muhammad to shed some light on this question. Sheikh, the question, as it was actually asked or posed by the questioner, was actually presented to you. But as far as I know, this is what I have heard. The women. The wives of Abel and Cain were not sisters. If I'm not sure, let me learn it from you, Sheikh.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Again, is a very valid question and frequently asked question about how incest or incestuary marriage is allowed in Islam or not. First of all, let me mention one point. When we say that, for example, in the verses of Noble Quran or the narrations of Noble Prophet and his few progeny, when they mention that incest or incest marriage is forbidden, this particular action itself has some evil inside in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is from Shia point of view and from Shia jurisprudence, it has been mentioned and firmly believed. All the scholars, they believe in that. When you say that action is forbidden, it means that it contains some evil inside in it, and mm-hmm. because of that evil, and because it has some wrongdoing inside in it, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made it forbidden, and it is forbidden until the day of judgment. From the beginning of the creation of universe till the day of judgment, it is forbidden because it has some mafsada or for example evil within it, and because of that it became forbidden. After that, we have two explanations for that. Of course, maybe we have more than two. We have many explanations for how, in the beginning of the creation, how the sons of Prophet Adam they had their marriage. But according to some of the scholars, and I have chosen these two explanations for that. First of all, it has before the Adam, there were some human beings, of course, with some differences, and the Prophet Adam was not a first human being.
Yeah.
And the sons of Adam, they get married with those people and with those individuals, with those girls, of course, I mean.
Yeah.
And because of that, the creation of human being, progeny of Adam has started. Mm-hmm. So with those people, with those community and generations before Adam, mm-hmm. they get married. Another explanation is that, and of course this is from a narration from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. First of all, he mentioned that it is not allowed and it is not acceptable that Imam mentions that, and I'm giving the gist of the narration, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to continue the progeny of human being,
mm-hmm.
including many prophets and many awsiya, many vicegerents of the noble of the prophets. Their actually generation was from forbidden action. Imam said it is not acceptable mm-hmm. that how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did that. And second, after the murder of Abel, Prophet Adam cried a lot, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave him another son by the name of Hibatullah or Shaykh. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam explained that. And of course, this Shaykh was a vicegerent and successor of Adam. And after him, after the Hibatullah or Shaykh, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave him Yafith. It has been mentioned the names of the children and the sons of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when they become mature, sent two angels, we call it Huri, okay,
yeah.
to them. And they get married with those angels by the name of Nazle. She was a wife of Shaykh. And the Manzile, she was a wife of Yafith. And of course, they